So usually when we talk about high-level cybersecurity, we kind of default to this cinematic expectation,
Oh,
right?
absolutely. Like the whole Hollywood hacker thing.
Exactly. We picture the dark web, custom malware, these masterminds who can just bypass firewalls without leaving a single digital footprint.
Yeah, the guy in the hoodie in a dark room.
Right. And we build up this myth of the infallible digital threat because honestly, I think it justifies why our data feels so incredibly vulnerable all the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, that mastermind archetype, it basically acts as a psychological buffer for us.
How do you mean?
Because if the people stealing our data are these untouchable geniuses, right, then the average organization can't really be blamed when their defenses inevitably
Oh,
fail.
that makes a lot of sense. Like, we didn't fail, they were just too good.
Exactly. But when you actually look at the forensic breakdown of major cyber syndicates, that whole Hollywood narrative just completely dissolves. The reality of digital security is shockingly and honestly sometimes embarrassingly human.
Which is the perfect starting point for today's deep dive. So, welcome everyone. Today we are pulling from the Tech and Knight Digital Security and Innovation Digest.
And that's the one dated today, right? Sunday, May 17, 2026.
Yep, fresh off the presses. And our mission for this deep dive with you today is to trace a very specific through line in today's tech landscape. We are looking at the shifting balance of power in the digital age.
Which is such a massive topic right now.
It really is. We're trying to figure out who actually holds the keys to our data, our devices, and frankly, even our basic perception of reality.
Yeah, it's a systemic tug of war. I mean, we are seeing it play out across global data privacy frameworks all the way down to, the underlying architecture of the device you might be holding right now.
Totally. So just to give you a roadmap of where we're heading today, first we're going to look at a $2.3 million hacker syndicate that got taken down by, of all things, mundane office compliance protocols.
That story is just wild.
It's unbelievable. Then we'll examine why an entire European nation is currently trading its collective cognitive data for free ChatGPT Plus.
A fascinating experiment.
And then we'll unpack a looming Wednesday deadline that has thousands of e-reader owners racing to basically jailbreak and rewrite their devices.
Because every single one of these developments really challenges what we think of as digital sovereignty.
Right, so let's just jump right into what has to be the most spectacular operational security failure of 2026.
Oh, by far.
This is the case of Marcus and Michael Chen. They're 34-year-old twin brothers who spent the last, I think, 24 months running this highly sophisticated database extortion ring.
Massively successful, too.
Yeah, they compromised 96 different databases across 12 countries, healthcare providers, financial institutions, retail chains, and they extracted over 47 million records.
And their methodology was ruthless. I mean, the extortion model relied on finding exposed databases, exfiltrating all the data, completely wiping the original servers, and then demanding a ransom.
So they didn't just lock it up, they took it and erased the original.
Right, exactly. And they successfully collected over $2.3 million doing this. They carefully funneled the payouts through Bitcoin and Monero tumblers to, obscure the ledger trails.
Classic money laundering for the crypto age.
Yep. They utilized Tor networks, layered their VPNs. They functionally did everything by the book to evade detection. The FBI had been investigating these breaches for months with zero actionable leads.
Until March 15th.
Right. The fateful day.
So the twins sit down for a routine operational planning session, right? Just to coordinate their next wave of targets. And the platform these untraceable masterminds choose for their secure comms.
Microsoft Teams.
Microsoft Teams.
Which is just a fascinating psychological blind spot when you think about it.
I mean, why would they use that?
Well, criminal syndicates often default to legitimate enterprise-grade collaboration tools because honestly, the infrastructure is reliable, the video latency is low.
Oh, so they just wanted a good connection.
Yeah, exactly. But in doing so, they subject themselves to the architecture of that enterprise software.
And this is where it gets so good. So one of the brothers decides to record the session, presumably to like review the target list later, but he forgets to stop the recording.
A classic mistake.
But more importantly, he completely misunderstands the environment he's operating in.
Oh.
Because they weren't using burner accounts, they were utilizing a compromised Microsoft Office 365 tenant that belonged to one of their victims.
Right, a small healthcare provider.
Exactly.
And that is where the technical architecture actually turns into a trap. Because when you hijack an enterprise tenant, you don't just get access to their software, you inherit their enterprise governance policies.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this healthcare provider, probably to maintain medical compliance, they had an overarching administrative policy that automatically synced and saved all teams' recordings directly to a centralized, monitored corporate OneDrive.
So the hackers essentially weaponized their victims' compliance software against themselves.
They did.
So the victims' IT administrators are just running a routine audit. They notice this large video file generated under a suspicious login. So they open it. And what did they find?
It is a 45-minute, high-definition video of the extortionists.
Unbelievable.
Real names. Faces clearly visible on the webcam. Detailed discussions of the 96 victims, their crypto wallet seed phrases, and the specific vulnerabilities of their future targets.
It's just the seamlessness of modern corporate productivity tools inadvertently created an unerasable surveillance state for the criminals.
They practically handed over the evidence folder.
Basically. I mean, the FBI had them in custody in San Francisco within 72 hours. And now they're looking at up to 100 years in federal prison for wire fraud, extortion, and money laundering.
It's like a bank robber breaking into a vault, entirely bypassing the lasers and the biometric scanners, right?
Yeah.
But then accidentally hitting the bank's automated time lock button while they're still standing inside the vault.
That is a perfect analogy.
Okay.
And honestly, it forces a complete reevaluation of how we view operational security.
How so?
Well, we obsess over cryptographic algorithms, zero-day vulnerabilities, but the integrity of any digital system is ultimately bound by human behavioral mechanics.
Right.
The human is the weak link.
Exactly. If professional hackers, whose physical freedom depends entirely on strict OPSEC, can fail to understand the automated retention policies of a cloud tenant, then the average corporate employee doesn't stand a chance.
That's a scary thought.
It is. But it completely validates why modern cybersecurity frameworks are moving toward zero trust architectures. You just have to assume the user will always make the fatal error.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's incredible how a rigid, top-down software interface completely stripped these hackers of their power. But, you know, that dynamic, that tension between what a user wants to do and what the software forces them to do, It isn't just happening to cyber criminals.
Oh, definitely not.
We are seeing a massive pushback from everyday users demanding control over their own interfaces. Which brings us to our second topic from the digest, the latest Microsoft Insider Preview build.
Build 26.120 for Windows 11.
That's the one.
This is actually a really significant pivot in Microsoft's design philosophy.
Yeah, because according to the digest, Microsoft is finally backing down on the locked-in design of the Windows 11 Start menu.
Right.
Users are regaining the ability to resize the menu dynamically. You can detach the taskbar, anchor it to the top, left or right of your screen. You can pin up to 36 apps at once, and you can finally permanently disable that algorithmic recommended file section.
Which is huge. To really contextualize why this is a major development, we have to look at the telemetry and feedback data.
Okay, lay it on me.
So taskbar customization has been the number one requested feature on the Windows Feedback Hub for years. It accumulated over 250,000 upvotes.
Wow, 250,000 people actively complaining.
Right. And Start menu resizing sat at number 3 with about 180,000 votes. But when Windows 11 launched, Microsoft intentionally stripped away these modular features, which, by the way, were completely standard in Windows 10.
Right, I remember that.
Yeah, they removed them in favor of this locked, centralized, Apple-esque aesthetic.
But let me ask you this. Is this just too little, too late? I mean, if 65% of the global user base is still stubbornly running Windows 10 right now, here in May 2026, this feels less like a benevolent design update and more like a desperate attempt to stop the bleeding.
That's spot on.
Because they built an interface nobody wanted, and the users just collectively refused to migrate.
Yeah, the adoption metrics absolutely forced their hand here. Power users were already bypassing the operating system's restrictions entirely.
Oh, by installing those third-party UI modifiers.
Exactly. Tools like StartAllBack or Explore Patcher, they were essentially rewriting the Windows 11 shell to behave like Windows 10.
Just to get their Start menu back.
Right. And when an OS developer sees millions of users installing third-party software just to fix basic navigation, that becomes a severe security and stability liability.
Makes sense.
They had to capitulate because that stubbornness was impacting enterprise upgrade cycles and hardware sales across the board.
Well, it proves that when the user base holds the line, they can successfully claw back software control from a tech giant.
It's a rare win for the users, honestly.
It is. But while Microsoft is kind of learning the hard way that you can't dictate software utility, another tech giant is utilizing an entirely different mechanism to force obsolescence.
Yes.
They aren't locking down the software. They are remotely killing the physical hardware.
The Amazon Kindle end of support deadline.
Exactly. Just 3 days from now, on Wednesday, May 20, Amazon is severing support for millions of older Kindle models.
We're talking about the pre-2018 generation here, right?
Yep. The Kindle Voyage, the 7th Gen Basic, the early Paperwhites. After Wednesday, those devices lose cloud synchronization, security patches, and the ability to purchase or download books directly from the Amazon storefront.
Which is an incredibly aggressive acceleration of device depreciation. Because the hardware itself, the ink displays, the batteries, the physical chassis, it all remains entirely functional.
They still work perfectly fine as e-readers.
Exactly. But by severing the network authentication, the manufacturer effectively turns a functioning piece of technology into a paperweight.
And the response in the digital preservation community has been intense. According to the Digest, the Mobile Read forums are reporting a 400% spike in traffic specifically related to jailbreaking these targeted devices.
Right, they're flashing the firmware.
Yeah, users are manually installing open source environments like Curator. They're bypassing the Amazon ecosystem entirely so they can load their own EPUB files, run custom typography, and sync using third-party cloud protocols.
This really cuts straight to the core of the right to repair movement. Historically, you know, physical ownership meant perpetual utility. If you bought a physical book, you owned the book.
Nobody could remotely delete your paperback.
Exactly. But the proliferation of smart devices introduced this fundamental shift from ownership to licensing. You possess the physical plastic and silicon, but you are merely licensing the operating system required to make it function.
Wow.
And when the manufacturer revokes that license, your hardware autonomy just vanishes. Now, objectively speaking, jailbreaking voids warranties, but it is generally perfectly legal for personal use, assuming you aren't pirating content.
Right. But let me push back on the scale of this for a second. Because the enthusiast community flashing custom firmware onto a 10-year-old e-reader, I mean, it feels like a very niche rebellion.
You think so?
Well, most consumers are just going to shrug, trade it in for a $20 discount, and buy the new model, right?
Right.
Is this actually a critical consumer rights crusade, or just a vocal minority of tech nerds refusing to let go of legacy gadgets? It feels a bit like retrofitting a cassette player with Bluetooth.
That's a fair point, and the behavior of the individual consumer might seem trivial, but the macro-level economics and the environmental impacts are staggering.
Okay, what do the numbers look like?
Well, the Digest cites an estimated 15 million of these specific legacy Kindles currently in active circulation.
15 million, wow.
Yeah. If even half of that user base abandons the hardware because of this network cutoff, that is 7.5 million lithium-ion batteries and display panels entering the waste stream simultaneously.
Oh, the e-waste footprint alone, that's massive.
Precisely. Global e-waste generation crossed 53.6 million metric tons several years ago, and forced obsolescence is a primary driver of that.
I had no idea it was that high.
It's a crisis. This is exactly why the European Union has been aggressively legislating right to repair mandates. They're attempting to legally obligate manufacturers to decouple hardware functionality from continuous server authentication.
So the Kindle jailbreaking spike isn't just a hobby.
Not at all. It's really a grassroots mitigation of an environmental crisis that is being directly caused by corporate software policies.
That completely reframes it. So we have users fighting tooth and nail to maintain control over aging physical hardware. But if we zoom out to the sovereign level, we actually see a totally inverted dynamic.
Oh, you're talking about Malta.
Yes. There is a government that isn't fighting tech companies to preserve old hardware. They are actively handing over their citizens' cognitive data in exchange for bleeding-edge AI integration.
The bilateral agreement between OpenAI and the Republic of Malta, honestly, this is arguably the most significant geopolitical tech development of the month.
It's wild. So on May 15th, Malta, which is a nation of about 520,000 people, they finalized a deal to provide every single citizen age 16 and older with a free 12-month subscription to ChatGPT Plus.
Which normally costs, what, about $20 a month?
Yeah, it's a $240 retail value per citizen. And to activate the subscription, the citizen simply has to complete and pass an 8-hour state-sponsored AI literacy course.
covering things like practical prompt engineering, algorithmic ethics, data verification, things like that.
Right. So break down the economics of this agreement for us, because the incentives for both parties seem incredibly revealing.
They really are. So Malta is spending approximately $5 million to administer the literacy program and the testing infrastructure. But in exchange, they are injecting a theoretical $124.8 million in software value directly into their economy.
That is quite the return on investment.
Well, absolutely. Their strategic goal is to basically overnight transform their population into the most densely AI literate workforce in the European Union. They want to attract tech investment and modernize their domestic industries.
But OpenAI isn't a charity.
Definitely not.
I mean, they aren't absorbing over $100 million in server compute costs out of goodwill. What is the actual currency changing hands here?
The currency is longitudinal nation-scale behavioral data.
Okay, unpack that.
OpenAI is gaining an unprecedented enclosed demographic sandbox. They get to monitor exactly how an entire society integrates a large language model across every possible socioeconomic layer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They'll see how local government clerks automate administration, how students utilize it for advanced mathematics, how local businesses optimize their logistics.
It's like a massive societal telemetry experiment. It's like a national gym membership for the brain. But the gym gets to record exactly how every single citizen lifts the weights.
That is exactly what it is.
But that raises an immediate red flag regarding digital sovereignty. I mean, you have a private entity based in San Francisco gaining granular access to the daily queries, professional drafts, and potentially sensitive personal thoughts of a sovereign European population.
Now, objectively, the agreement does stipulate that all query data is aggregated and anonymized.
Right. But is that enough?
Well, privacy advocates rightly point out that large language models are inherently designed to extract and retain contextual nuances. When an entire nation routes its digital cognition through a single proprietary algorithmic bottleneck, the concept of data privacy becomes incredibly fragile.
Yeah, because Malta is embracing this black box algorithm on a macro level. But at the exact same time, we're seeing intense consumer backlash against AI integration on a micro level.
Right. The anxiety over algorithmic control is bleeding into how we capture reality itself.
Just look at the immediate PR crisis Sony just had to navigate.
Oh, the launch of the Xperia 1/13th smartphone.
Yeah. So Sony releases this promotional video highlighting their new AI camera assistant. And the marketing made it appear as though the smartphone was actively hallucinating reality.
Probably terrified people.
Yeah. It looked like it was generating entirely new angles or physically manipulating the subjects in the frame after the photo was taken. The backlash was immediate. Users were terrified that the camera was faking their memories.
Right.
Sony had to issue a massive technical breakdown proving the AI only functions pre-shutter. But why the panic?
Well, the panic stems from a fundamental misunderstanding of how modern computational photography differs from traditional optics.
Okay.
A traditional camera lens simply captures the photons hitting the sensor, right? But competitors like Google and Samsung, they've integrated generative AI directly into the processing pipeline.
Like those Magic Eraser commercials.
Exactly. Tools like Magic Eraser or Samsung's Scene Optimizer, they don't just capture light. They use adjacent pixels and vast training models to mathematically hallucinate details that were never there. They remove people, alter lighting, or artificially merge multiple exposures post-shot.
So they're essentially painting a new image over the original photon capture.
Exactly. So Sony had to publicly verify that their AI assistant only analyzes the scene to suggest manual adjustments.
Like suggesting a different ISO or something.
Right. Recommending an ISO change, a shift in white balance, or a different exposure time, but all before the user physically triggers the shutter. Mm-hmm. They had to assure the market that they are preserving optical reality rather than algorithmically generating it.
You know, it's the exact same anxiety driving the pushback against Windows and the Kindle obsolescence. The moment we feel an algorithm making choices on our behalf, especially in a way we can't fully transparently observe, we reject it.
Absolutely.
Because when we blindly trust algorithms to dictate our digital experience without demanding accountability, the consequences are devastating.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the final story from the Digest. The landmark legal settlement announced on May 16th.
The class action resolution involving Snap, YouTube, TikTok, and the school districts of Brethitt County, Kentucky.
This is huge.
It is a foundational shift in tech liability jurisprudence.
So these platforms agreed to a settlement estimated between $150 and $200 million. But this wasn't a case about data privacy.
Yeah, not at all.
The schools successfully argued that the core architectural features of these applications, so the infinite scroll mechanics, the auto-playing videos, the algorithmic content curation, were structurally defective products that caused measurable neurological harm to students.
And to really understand this legal victory, you have to understand the neurobiology that the platforms were exploiting.
Let's hear it.
Features like the infinite scroll are engineered around this concept of variable ratio reinforcement. The user's brain doesn't know if the next swipe will deliver highly engaging content or just something mundane.
Like a slot machine.
Exactly like a slot machine. That unpredictability triggers a dopamine reward prediction error. It neurologically traps the user in a state of continuous anticipation, which actively overrides their executive function and their ability to self-regulate screen time.
And the digest highlights the specific metrics the schools use to prove these damages. This is hard data. Since the mass adoption of these algorithmic feeds, the average teenage attention span plummeted from 12 minutes to just 8 minutes.
That's a massive drop.
It gets worse. Clinical depression rates in that demographic spiked from 8% to 20%, and the average nightly sleep duration dropped by 2 full hours, from 8.5 to 6.5.
Historically, tech giants have insulated themselves against this exact type of litigation using frameworks like Section 230 in the U.S.
Right, arguing they're just neutral platforms.
Right. They claim they're just hosting third-party speech. But what this settlement does is effectively bypass the speech argument entirely. The plaintiffs didn't sue over the videos being watched. They sued over the delivery mechanism itself.
Oh, that is clever.
Very. They argued that the infinite scroll is a defective psychological product, basically no different than a poorly designed seatbelt or a toxic chemical compound.
So they're finally being held liable as product manufacturers, not just digital landlords. And the $200 million will fund dedicated mental health counseling and digital literacy programs across hundreds of districts.
Plus, the platforms are legally compelled to implement rigid, unbypassable parental controls.
Right. But I have to ask, does throwing $200 million at the problem actually fix an algorithm designed to be fundamentally addictive? Can a one-time payout buy back 4 lost minutes of attention span? Also, I noticed a glaring omission in the list of companies that settled. Where is Meta?
Well, Meta, the parent organization of Facebook and Instagram, deliberately opted out of the settlement negotiations. They are choosing to litigate the claims in federal court.
Why would they do that?
Their legal strategy likely relies on setting a definitive appellate precedent. They want to prove that algorithmic design is inextricably linked to free expression. They're hoping to shut down the product liability angle entirely before it triggers a wave of federal regulation.
But the regulatory wave is already building. I mean, the Digest notes that the UK and Australia are rapidly advancing stringent age verification mandates and legislative duty of care standards. This is a bellwether case. The financial liability isn't theoretical anymore. It's costing them hundreds of millions of dollars.
And with over 1,000 similar lawsuits pending, this is just the beginning.
Let's synthesize everything we've pulled from today's sources, because we have mapped a truly complex ecosystem for you today. We watched a multi-million dollar extortion ring collapse because they couldn't untangle themselves from enterprise cloud compliance.
Yep.
We saw PC users successfully force a massive corporation to yield control over basic user interfaces. We observed thousands of consumers rewriting their hardware's firmware to survive a corporate-mandated death sentence.
The e-waste angle alone was eye-opening.
Truly. We analyzed an entire nation trading its daily cognitive output for AI supremacy. And we finally saw the legal system penalize social platforms for weaponizing human neurobiology.
The through line here is unmistakable. The era of passive digital consumption is entirely over. Every interaction, from resizing a taskbar to allowing a camera algorithm to process a photograph, is a micro-negotiation over sovereignty.
The illusion was always that the infrastructure providers, the Microsoft, the Amazons, the OpenAIs, held absolute authority. But the reality is that the systems only function and generate value through our behavioral participation.
And when users push back, the architecture has to adapt.
Exactly.
I mean, if we look at the whole trajectory from hardware preservation to national data harvesting, it forces a critical reevaluation of our role in the digital economy.
What's a takeaway for the listener?
If our physical devices are systematically designed to outlast their corporate support lifespans, and our daily digital interactions are quietly serving as the primary training data for the next generation of global AI models, it leads to a pretty provocative conclusion.
Let's hear it.
In the technological landscape of 2026, you really have to ask yourself, are you still the consumer of these products, or have you actually become the source code?
Wow. that reframes everything we just discussed. We started by marveling at hackers who defeated their own elaborate security by fundamentally misunderstanding the tools they were using. But the larger vulnerability isn't leaving a recording running in the cloud.
No, it's not.
The real vulnerability is navigating this digital age without realizing that we are no longer just operating the machinery. We are the fuel it requires to function. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, verify your automated settings, and we'll catch you next time.